So I'm going to be talking about using our Via Láctea 2 simulation to make predictions for what glass could possibly see from annihilations in substructures. And this is work done with Jörg Diemann, who's here, and Piero Mardell, both at Santa Cruz. So let's just go forward. Okay, I mean, I don't really have to tell you guys there's what's going on. Why is this? Is it on some sort of, it's going through automatically? So. Pause. Okay, there we go. Sorry for the technical difficulties. Okay, so here's just my overview slide. There's evidence for dark matter on many different scales. I don't have to tell you. There's CMB clusters, satellites. There's some tomography in the universe. The point of this slide is just to say that on the smallest scales that we observe evidence for dark matter for, we've heard about this now from lots of different people's work. There's dwarf galaxies are kind of the smallest scales for which we have evidence for dark matter. But from theory, we expect actually dark matter to cluster to much smaller scales. So here, come on. There we go. Okay, so this is some theoretical work by Green et al. That shows what the power spectrum of fluctuations looks like when you go down to the very small scale, so large k's here. And this cutoff in the power spectrum is just set essentially due to the velocity dispersion of the dark matter particle, so the free streaming after decoupling. And there's some collisional damping as well. So you can, I did it again. So you can convert this to a mass scale. This is work by Profumo and Sigurdsson and Kamiankowski. So you have a kinetic decoupling temperature. And this is for a whole range of different dark matter particle physics models. So either minimal supersymmetric extensions of the standard model, or M-Suger model, or some universal extra dimension models. And the point here is just that these predict a whole bunch of different masses and decoupling temperatures. All these different points are models that give a relic abundance of dark matter that agrees with what WMAP has measured. And then you can translate this into a smallest mass of collapsed dark matter structures. So here in terms of Earth masses, you can see there's a wide range going down from maybe 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the 2 Earth masses or so. I'm sure this is not the most definite calculation one can make, but this just sort of gives you an idea that there's a range of lowest mass dark matter halos that you expect if cold dark matter is the theory of the dark matter particle.
Minus six.
So that would depend on what sigma you're talking about. You know, the typical one is maybe 30, 40. I mean, I don't have a number in my head right now. So if you go to a higher sigma peak, so we did some simulations with Europe where we looked at a 3 sigma peak in there, it ended up being more like 70 or 80.
So that's for 10 to the minus 6 solar mass.
That was, yeah.
Or Earth mass.
That was for 10 to the minus 6 solar mass. Yeah, so, okay, so if you want to study this, well, we've heard a lot about how you can study this from using analytical models, which is very impressive. We've chosen to go the numerical way. So if you, the reason why you go to numerics is because we're in really highly nonlinear clustering regimes. So just simple analytics don't work. You have to either do semi-analytics or numerical simulation. So we've heard a lot about the Via Láctea simulations. Now we've most of the stuff we've seen is the first one. I would show you a movie, but that's not possible at the moment. So this is an image of the very first one, the Via Láctea simulation, the first generation one that we ran. It was run on the Columbia supercomputer. Here are the sort of vitals of the simulation. Had a few hundred million particles, 20,000 solar mass, particle resolution. It was run with a WMAP 3-year cosmology. And it didn't, we call it a Milky Way halo. We essentially just picked a Milky Way scale halo in a large 90 megaparsec box and stuck all the high resolution particles into that halo and resolved it at unprecedented resolution. Now, we've written a number of papers sort of describing the substructure population and its evolution over time based on that simulation. Now, recently we've completed Via Láctea 2, which is the second generation one of this. So it has a billion particles now. They have a 4,000 solar masses. And it's again a Milky Way scale halo. So this is, why am I doing that? This is a sort of a snapshot of what it looks like at redshift zero. again, you've seen these kind of plots before, so there's nothing really dramatically new here. It's just that we're resolving a larger range of hierarchies than has been done before. There's two other sort of snapshots or that I'm showing here, which is just the inner 40 KPC projected just in density, and up here projected in phase-based density. So the space-based density is not just rho over sigma cubed as people have estimated it, but actually using sort of an adaptive gridding method to calculate what the phase-based density is, and then projecting it in the inner 40 KPC. And so you can see while just in looking at density, a lot of the substructure is kind of washed out. You only see a few of these subhalos. When you look at phase-based density, there's streams and a lot more of these subhalos appear. So this is going to be ongoing work analyzing this and turning this into more quantitative predictions. Right now it's just a sort of qualitative picture. Let's see. Okay, so I wanted to say just a few words about the substructure population that we get out of Via Láctea 2. So here on the left, I'm plotting just the, actually this is the density profile of the host halo in total. I've been asked about this a number of times this week. So this is again just one realization. So the point that Andrew made is true, that we need to have a, if we wanted to make a statement about, you know, what is the central density profile for dark matter halos in general, one really should look at a statistical distribution, run many, many simulations. But for this one, which is the currently most resolved one, we could see that the density profile sort of follows this expected form, becoming slightly shallower towards the center. And we've tried to fit it both with a generalized NFW profile, where the central slope is free to asymptotes to value gamma, or with this iNosto profile, which has recently been advocated as a good fitting formula, in which case you don't actually have a, well, the, you have a core in the sense when you go to the very inner regions, the slope becomes zero. And so we actually find that our halo is best fit with a generalized NFW profile with a central slope of about 1.2. This is this blue curve here. And the iNosto profile is not much worse than the NFW profile, but statistically a little bit inferior. And especially in the central regions, it actually underpredicts the densities. The numerical resolution, the numerical simulation, of course, is going to be underpredicting the densities there. And the fit, the fit is underpredicting it. It has lower densities in the center than the simulation does. Yeah, right, or 1.2. So I'm also showing here the density profiles of a number of subhalos, and you can see that they also kind of follow a very similar distribution. So of course it's harder to probe the inner regions of those, but the slopes are sort of consistent with 1.2 and the scatter of about 0.2. All right, so it depends on what you're asking for. For the density profile, it's 380 parsec.
So it's 3 times 3?
Yes.
Okay.
So that doesn't mean that you resolve the substructure population after those scales. Okay, here I'm plotting the velocity functions that we've seen a number of times before now. This is for all subhalos, and then this is within 100 kpc and within 50 kpc. And this is well fit by this power law, Vmax, normalized to Vmax host to the -3. And this is in agreement with what other people have published in the literature within the scatter. And then interestingly enough, I'll talk a bit more about that later. We resolve enough of the substructure and the substructure to make these kind of Vmax plots for individual subhalos, and that's what's plotted here. And once you normalize to a value of Vmax of the host of the substructure that you're considering, then you can see that these all sort of fall more or less on top of each other with some scatter that, again, is consistent with what you find in the field.
Mm-hmm. Smaller physical density than a big halo. Is that a generally true statement?
In the very center?
Yes.
Okay, so then two more points about the substructure population. Here's the radial number density profile. So it turns out not to exactly follow the mass distribution, but actually be somewhat anti-biased. You're less likely to find subhalos in the inner regions than you are in the outer regions. And that, again, is well known and has been discussed in the literature before. We're just, again, seeing this. This is due to just subhalos in the inner regions being preferentially, the tidal forces are stronger and are able to disrupt them more. Then here's something new that hasn't really been shown so much in literature before, is the concentration of subhalos increases towards the center. So we're using a little bit different definition of concentration. call this delta V, which is the overdensity within RV max, the mean overdensity within RV max normalized to rho crit here. And you can see that when you bend them up by where you find these subhalos today, you can see that there's a trend with radius. So if you want to convert this to the normal concentration that you're used to, then this would go as radius to the minus 2.9 or so.
Are you going to try to figure out what that left one would look like with, say, like just the most massive?
No, I'm not. This is not the focus of this talk. I'm going to veer away from the missing satellite discussion and go towards making predictions for GLAST. Oh, yes?
Is that the fact of the sigma peak?
So, could you say that again?
The fact that some colors are more concentrated in the inner region is the fact of the sigma peak?
Partially. So there's two effects there. It's partially that, you know, subhalos that end up in the center came from higher sigma peaks formed earlier, were more concentrated, but also it's just due to tidal disruption. So the way this is defined is just the overdensity within RV max. So if you have tidal stripping and it eats away from the outside in, and eventually maybe eats in even beyond RV max, then you end up with a higher central, a higher overdensity within RV max. So it's a combination of those two effects. So now I see that in my conversion to PDF, I have a bunch of slides in here from previous talk that I'm not going to talk about now. So I'm just going to skip next to the GLAST satellite, which I'm trying to make predictions for. So here's a comparison of GLAST versus looking at this. Yeah, so we've all been holding our breath, and I was actually hoping that there would be a live feed of it today at the launch that we could watch, but now we'll have to wait until next week or possibly later. But here's just a comparison of what the last detector on GLAST is going to be capable of compared to EGRID. So it extends the energy sensitivity by a factor of 10 and has a much higher peak effective area, a much larger field of view, better. It's pretty much better in all regards. And then I'm considering here possible dark matter annihilation sources that GLAST could detect. In general, you would consider the galactic center annihilation as a density squared process, so you want to care about where you have high densities. The galactic center is a point where you want to look at maybe pre-existing dwarf galaxies, or maybe subhalos, a nearby subhalo that doesn't actually have stars in it. Or you could also consider looking at clusters, external clusters. I'm going to be focusing on these subhalos, so dwarf galaxies and nearby subhalos. But you should also keep in mind that it's possible to maybe observe a sort of cosmic gamma ray background from annihilation throughout a cosmic discrete. Okay, so here's sort of the master equation that governs how many gamma ray photons you would expect to receive from a given direction based on dark matter annihilation. So it has contributions both from astrophysics, essentially just the line of sight integral of the dark matter density squared. Rho squared over r squared is the flux, but then you're integrating out over a solid angle that goes as r squared. Then you have contributions from particle physics, so the cross section and the mass of the dark matter particle, and the spectrum of gamma rays you get from a given annihilation event. And then you have to integrate over some detector properties like the effective area as a function of energy. And you have the resolution of the instrument and the exposure time. So what I'm going to be talking about is plugging in numbers for all these different quantities and actually coming up with an all-sky map of detectability of subhalos in the sky from GLAST. So just a few words about the particle physics. This is very uncertain, of course, so I'm going to be really restricting myself to a particular model, namely the neutralino WIMP dark matter. And in that case, there's many other different models that one can consider, and in some cases they may not even annihilate or produce any kind of gamma ray signal. But just for the sake of making predictions for GLAST, I'm going to be considering this kind of a model. So you have two dark matter particles that are annihilating, and they can actually produce a wide range of different electromagnetic signatures. So if you have charged pions that can decay to electrons and positrons, and those can interact with the magnetic field and give you synchrotron, or you have constant scattering, there's many different sort of electromagnetic signatures you can get out of this. I'm going to be focusing on the gamma ray signal, which comes from the decay of pions. There's also a direct channel that gives you just two monochromatic photons, but since this is a suppressed quantum mechanically, I'm just going to go with this one, which gives you the majority of gamma ray photons. And so what exactly happens in annihilation is really dependent on the exact particle physics model you choose. So usually the end product can be some, you know, gauge boson or quark or something like that, and then those will decay through pions and give you gamma rays.
What do you have? Something.
So if you have relativistic electrons,
And you have like a satellite there with Flutter. I'm not sure what.
Yeah, you would have to ask Sergio. Hold on, Francesco.
Yes.
I just stole that slide from him a few years back. Or he was willing to give it to me, I should say it like that. I'm focusing on this part. Here's another slide from Sergio. He's plotting, again, this is like a range of neutralino masses and cross-sections. And all the green dots are ones that reproduce the WMAP relic abundance. There's just to point out that there's really a wide range of masses, and actually this can extend to higher masses and also to lower cross-sections. What I'm going to be saying in this talk is that for sort of this range of parameter space that's plotted here, GLASS is possibly going to be able to detect subhalos, individual subhalos.
I cannot see the y-axis.
This goes from 10 to the minus 26, 10 to the minus 25, up to 10 to the minus 24.
24?
Yeah, there's some, I know most people really consider more of this range, but if you look in the literature, you can find models that give you higher cross-sections too. I'm actually considering this region from 10 to the minus 26 to 10 to the minus 25, up to 500 GeV.
I think that Lydia showed the part that there's a upper limit from Migret, basically. So
I'll get to that. Okay. Again, slides I'm not going to talk about. Okay, so here's what you get when you actually apply this directly just from the simulations. I've just binned up the sky in pixels that have about the width that you expect in glass angular resolution to have, which is 9 arc minutes, at energies above 3 GeV. And so yeah, I have 2,400 pixels in the longitude direction and 1,200 pixels in the latitude direction. And I've just binned up the density squared flux from all the different subhalos. So you can see, of course, the overall galactic halo, and you can see a lot of these individual subhalos. This is, again, like Lydia was showing, not a sensitivity map or a detectability map, just sort of what you get directly out of the simulations. And the question that arises is, okay, earlier we saw this picture with all these thousands of subhalos. If you look at this, it doesn't seem like there's really that many. So a few things about that is that we think that the fluxes of the subhalos that we get from the simulations are under predictions, and we should really be upwards correcting them somewhat, and that is called the boost factor. And there's two different reasons for thinking that we should be applying a boost factor. One is that in our simulations, the central regions are under-resolved, so we really should be correcting for that. So in our simulations, maybe the simulations, the halos actually have a core profile, whereas we expect from studies of larger mass halos that they should really have a cusp. And then also, our simulations can only resolve a limited range of substance structure. So this is from a paper that Pierre and I wrote came out last year, where this is based on Via Lactea 1. We were sort of trying to get an estimate of the boost factor from looking at the overall subhalo population in the whole halo. So what I'm plotting here is the mass of the subhalos, and then on the y-axis, the luminosity of the subhalos normalized to a smooth model of the halo, so there's the spherically symmetric density profile. So the luminosity of the subhalos here is estimated just the volume integral of the density squared, which for discrete particles is just the sum of the density plus the masses of the particles. What you can see is that it's pretty much linear with mass. The more mass the subhalo is, the more luminous it is. And then what you can see in this top line is sort of a sum over one decade in mass. This shows you that more or less the signal, the contribution from substructure is constant per decade of substructure mass. So this means that if we were to resolve a lot further down the mass hierarchy, then we would get more and more contributions from these subhalos to the overall boost. So it turns out that from our simulations, so we find about 10 to 15% contributions per decade, this number here. So that means over the 3 or 4 orders of magnitude of substructure that we resolve, we get a factor of 1.5 boost. We extrapolated this all the way down to the lowest mass cutoffs, then maybe we'd get a boost factor of 3 to 5. And this doesn't actually account for the fact that substructure and further down the hierarchy could actually further boost your.
How sensitive is this to the slope that we're assuming?
Well, this is not assuming any slope. This comes directly out of the simulations. So
but this boost factor.
You mean the slope of the subhalos.
Are you talking about the mass function slope?
No, I mean the cusp slope.
Yeah, so this one is not, correcting anything. I'm sorry, I'm missing, jumping around a little bit. Right now, this is just directly from just summing up the particles times the masses. So I'm not putting any correction for this. So next, though, we're going to go to.
So actually, on this plot, so this factor of 1.5, you've done this with VLACTA.
I haven't actually redone this yet for VLACTA.
So this per decade, do you think this changes with this, with the higher resolution or not?
No.
And the other thing, if instead of like identifying subhalo, you just smooth the simulation, like smooth the density within.
For finding the subhalos?
Rather than actually identifying subhalo, just smooth the density. So is it possible to do something similar?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
I'm just wondering, because subhalos, you have a way of finding subhalos, and I guess it's friend of friends or something like that. So, but I'm just wondering if is there a way not to be sensitive to the way you find stuff or define stuff? It's just a smooth simulation at some resolution.
Yeah, once we do that, we haven't done that because that wouldn't tell us about how much the substructure is contributing per decade. But
okay.
Yeah. Well, we've done the sum on over all the particles, like this on the lower right corner. If you sum all that up, compare that signal to what you get from just a smooth spherical average density profile, you get this factor.
Okay.
And that's completely independent of subhalo definition.
Yeah, that, there's a contribution there just from sort of triaxiality to and things like that.
And the logarithm.
That's cool. Okay. So in VLACTA 2, as I was mentioning before, we're now resolving a lot of the substructure. So these are four of the more massive subhalos, and you can see they're populated with a lot of subhalos. I call them in here. I'm just showing the plot again of the Vmax function of the substructure. And so this really should also go into the boost vector calculation. So then, to make any further progress, really to extend below the lower limit of our simulation, we resort to an analytic model. And this is inspired by some work that Louis did. So essentially, you define the boost factor of a halo, or the luminosity of a halo is 1 plus the boost factor of a given mass times the smooth mass luminosity that it would have. And it depends on the lower mass cutoff of the substructure mass hierarchy. And then you just integrate over it from some, again, this lower mass cutoff, M naught, up to some upper limit, which in this case we chose to be 0.01, to 1% of the host halo luminosity. And then you stick in the mass function that has a slope of alpha, and then you can solve this equation for the boost vector. Why is this? I mean, those colors, I don't really mind those colors. That's fine. There we go. I think it's on here. Okay, so this is what you get now. So I'm plotting two different things here. Here on the left side, I've fixed the slope to be 2, and I'm plotting the analytic boost factor that you get for a number of different lower mass cutoffs. Oh, and to answer your question, this is just assuming NFW. I haven't redone this yet for different central slopes. So what you get here is boost factors of 1, maybe up to 10 in sort of an optimistic case. Oh, and I'm plotting it as a function of the mass of the halo that we're considering. So then you can do the same thing for here, cutoff of 10 to the minus 6 and varying the slope of the subhalo mass function. And again, you find, so the green and below is sort of what's possibly allowed by simulations. And you can see that, again, you get on the maximally a boost factor of 10. So this is in contradiction to what some people have published in literature and speak of boost factors of hundreds or thousands. But just based on our subhalo population that we constrain from our simulations, we think you can't really get much more than 10 at most. Okay, so then what happens when I apply the boost factor? This is without boost factor. This is with boost factor. And I've actually also corrected the galactic center here because the galactic center is in our simulations below 380 parsec, not well resolved. So I've stuck in a power law there. This is for comparisons with EGRET later. And then this is just this substructure population. So I've subtracted out the smooth contribution without boost, with boost. Okay, so this is all very interesting, but if you want to make quantitative predictions for GLAST, you have to actually add a few more ingredients, as I showed before. So first of all, we have to pick a model, namely a mass for the dark matter particle and a cross-section, and then we also need to pick a spectrum. So for this, so here the approach is to just sort of try a whole bunch of different models, different cross-sections, different masses. Here, though, to make it not too complicated, I've sort of picked a particular model in which you have two dark matter particles annihilating to a B and B bar quarks, and then those are decaying through pions and giving you this spectrum. And these are just for different dark matter particle masses, ranging from 50 up to 500. This is the spectrum that we got calculated with Dark Susie, which is a publicly available code written by Paolo. Okay, so the next thing we assume are the GLAST parameters, which I just lifted from the GLAST webpage. It tells you what is the effective area as a function of energy, and also the angular resolution. So the angular resolution also depends on energy. If you sort of weight by the expected number of photons, and you average over the energy, then you get an angular resolution of 9 arc minutes above 3 GeV, which we use as our threshold. Okay, so then the last thing that we have to consider are backgrounds. If we really want to make predictions for how many subhalos should be detectable at some sigma, we need to compare it to some backgrounds. So we have a number of different backgrounds that we include. One is just the extragalactic contributions. So these are from unresolved blazars and things like that. And this was measured by EGRET, so we're just using that number as an energy dependence, goes as -e^-2.1. And then we have a galactic diffuse background, which just comes from cosmic rays that originate in supernovas and that then are scattering off of hydrogen in the galaxy and producing pions and then decay and give gamma rays. So for this, we're actually using the Galprop code, which was developed by Strong and Moskalenko to match the EGRET galactic, or to provide a model that can possibly explain the EGRET diffuse galactic background. So I'll get back to that in a second. And then we also consider two backgrounds from annihilation, namely the annihilation from the smooth host halo signal and also from subhalos that we can't detect, so the sort of cumulative contribution from all subhalos. I'll say a bit about all these. So here is what GLAST measured. EGRET measured. Okay, this is the EGRET all-sky gamma ray survey above 100 MeV. And so this is the spectrum that is shown here. And so there for a while, actually there still is a kind of a mystery that there is too much emission. Okay, so I should say these models, this blue model is sort of the standard model you get for the emission, the gamma ray emission from cosmic rays, including cosmic ray propagation in the galaxy. And if you compare to that, you see that there's an excess of EGRET photons above a GeV or so. So some people actually advocated dark matter annihilation to explain this discrepancy. I'm not going that route because I think there's also astrophysical explanations. So Strong found a model in which you actually can reproduce these observations by changing a little bit the spectrum of cosmic rays. So saying that the cosmic rays that we measure at Earth aren't really representative of the cosmic ray population in the whole galaxy. And they do a number of other adjustments and can actually reproduce the EGRET measurement. So I'm just using that model, which he calls the optimized model, to give me a gamma ray background in the galaxy. And it looks like this. So to zeroth order, it's really just proportional to the hydrogen column density in the galaxy. Of course, there's much more complicated physics involved in the cosmic ray propagation, but this is what it looks like. So this is one background. Then I wanted to say a word about the galactic center. So there's a constraint also from the galactic center. Namely, initially, EGRET found a source that was consistent with being from the galactic center, but then a reanalysis by Dan Hooper and Brenda Dingus showed that actually it can't be quite exactly at the galactic center, so they can exclude at very high confidence that there actually is a source directly at the galactic center from EGRET. So that kind of puts a limit on us on our models, because if we have a very peak profile in the center and we choose a parameter for the mass in the cross section that gives a large luminosity there, then that could possibly exceed this bound. So this is what these guys did here. They sort of were able to show that you can exclude a range of parameter space just based on this point source limit in the center. So we make sure that all our models also obey this constraint. So there are two different curves here. 10^-8, I think, is what applies for EGRET. And this is, I think, the GLAST constraint. Okay, so then there's two, as I mentioned, two backgrounds from annihilation itself. So there's the diffuse background from the host halo itself. So this is a background because I want to constrain whether or not we can actually detect individual subhalos. So they have to outshine this background. So this is just what comes out of the Via Láctea 1 simulation. This is what comes out of Via Láctea 2. You can see the higher resolution of that simulation allows us to push to smaller radii and hence to smaller degrees. And then because we still have this sort of flattening in the center due to numerical resolution, I've just put in an artificial power law slope, so power law 1, and this is 1.2. So I've played with that. And this is just to see whether or not our models exceed this EGRET point source limit in the center. So really, there's a general caveat here. We don't really know what the dark matter density of the galactic center is doing. In our simulations, we only have dark matter, but clearly there's going to be baryonic effects there. So there could be adiabatic contraction, which could increase the density in the center. But then there isn't really very much evidence for adiabatic contraction when you actually look at galaxies. Or there could be a stellar bar that could have removed some of the dark matter at the center. In the very center, you could have a dark matter spike due to a supermassive black hole, or if there was a binary black hole in the past, it could have ejected dark matter. So it's really kind of uncertain. So we don't really want to focus on the galactic center, and instead want to talk about the subhalo population. Okay, so here's the last background. This was heavily inspired by work that Lydia Pieri already talked about, actually a few days ago at the POSCOs. So essentially, this is the background that you get from all subhalos that are below the resolution limit. So if you believe CDM, the whole halo should be populated by something like 10 to the 15 subhalos. So at every given glass resolution element, there should be, you know, 10 to the 9 subhalos or so that are too faint to be detected individually, but they will together add up to a background. So if you want to make an analytic model for that, you have to perform this nasty multidimensional integral where you have the flux of every given halo, and then you have a substructure population that depends both on mass and distance from the galactic center, put in a concentration, and you average over the distribution of concentrations. And then you integrate all this up. And you can plot this as a function of angle. And so here's the host halo that I extracted from our simulations. And then I have a number of different models that just have different lower mass cutoffs or slopes in the mass function. And they span a wide range of fluxes. And the point is just they, at some angular scale, a few tens of degrees, maybe 50 degrees, that actually starts to exceed the flux from the host halos. That's exactly also what Lydia found. So her approach was just to run a whole bunch of different concentration mass relationship models. So that produced also a wide range of scatter, whereas I focused just on one concentration mass relation that played with the substructure mass function, the slopes, and also put in the concentration mass relation with scatter and also the radial dependence and so on. So in the end, our results actually aren't that different. And the point is that this is what is also constrained by the Egret extragalactic flux. So if you choose sigma v or masses such that the flux from this exceeds the Egret extragalactic background, then you're going to have a problem. So this puts a limit on it. And that's a bit hard to see. So this is sigma v over mx greater than 10 to the minus 28. Cubic centimeter per second. So we actually find that most of our parameter space that we model satisfies this limit. So we do consider it. We have, I think Lydia's conclusion was perhaps a little bit stronger. She found that most of the models would be excluded. When we do this, I don't find that this is that restrictive a constraint. So the models that I'm considering from 10 to the minus 25 to 10 to the minus 26 and masses from 50 to 500 GV essentially all obey this constraint. The difference could have to do with the fact that I'm using a slightly different mass function, namely one that is anti-biased. So, okay, so just to sort of recap what we did, we start with a simulation, the Eluctia 2 in this case. From that, we can extract the smooth mass distribution. We can add an artificial central cusp. And we have the subhalo population. We have a mass function and the spatial distribution and the concentration. And then we can use this information to calculate a boost factor. From this, we get a background. And this also allows us to get subhalo fluxes directly from the simulation that the boost factor then enhances. And then we add glass parameters and particle physics parameters. And that gives us then, for every pixel on the sky or for every subhalo on the sky, a detection significance, namely just sum up the number of signals, number of gamma rays that you receive from every subhalo, and divide by the square root of the number of background gamma rays you get from every subhalo. And that allows us to assign a detection significance to every subhalo. And this is what we get. So now I'm plotting here the number of subhalos that exceed a detection threshold of 5 as a function of the mass of the dark matter particle. In this case, I've chosen a cross-section of 3 times 10 to the minus 26, fiducial cross-section. And I'm plotting here how many you would expect to detect. And there's a range, which is because I chose 10 different randomly chosen observer positions. Since our simulated halo isn't spherically symmetric, it depends a little bit on where you place the observer. So this is then as a function of the low mass cutoff in the substructure hierarchy. And that's what I was talking about earlier with Andrew. It does have a little bit of an effect. So for an extreme case, you can get up to, in the most optimistic masses here, you get up to, you know, multiple dozens of subhalos. And of course, this falls off as you go to lower, as higher and higher particle masses. And then, yeah, this is that is not something we've done with these things. So they're less than the galactic center, so I think they would be okay. But I haven't gone in individual one to do that. Mm-hmm. No. So we go to, I go to all the subhalos and I sum up all the detectable pixels and produce a signal to noise for all of those pixels. Yes, that's, you'll see that in the next slide. So the point to take away from this is that with the sort of, yeah, I'm almost done, with the kind of reasonable parameters, masses from 50 GeV to 500 GeV and cross sections, you know, between 10 to the minus 25 and 10 to the minus 26, GLAST is likely to observe, you know, a handful, maybe a few dozen subhalos. Now, this doesn't say that, you know, these are the most likely particle physics parameters. There's a huge range of parameter space out there in which, you know, you'd be way down here and you wouldn't observe any. And also there's, you know, the possibility that the dark matter particle is an axion, in which case you wouldn't get any of this. So I'm not making the claim that GLAST will absolutely definitely see it, but it's just, there's an interesting parameter space in which you do actually expect GLAST to see subhalos. And so then there was just a question about the properties of the subhalos. So here I'm plotting the distribution of the number of pixels with which each subhalo is detected. And you can see that they're almost all resolved. So multiple pixel detections. This is now for different particle physics masses. And then we can look at the angle in the sky, and it turns out to be statistically consistent with isotropic. You're not preferentially seeing them on the poles or something like that. And then here I'm plotting histograms of the detection significance. So you can see some halos are detected at very high significances, up to 20, 30. And those actually turn out to be the most massive subhalos, the ones with the highest Bmaxes. But as you go to smaller and smaller detection significances, you still actually detect halos with lower and lower Bmaxes. So here, for example, you can see if you look at the solid blue curve, which is for 100 GeV, some of the detectable halos, which happen to be the highly significant ones, are at these high Vmax ones. But then there are definitely some that are, you know, have Vmaxes of 5 kilometers a second that are unlikely to harbor any kind of stars that would still be detectable. And you can look at the distribution of distances, and they turn out to be distributed roughly Gaussian and with a median of about 40 kpc.
Something else that produces.
Yeah, that's my second to last slide. So, right, so if we detected one of them, how would we be able to differentiate? This is not really my work, but Balt and Y wrote a nice paper on that. And there's multiple ways you can differentiate. The first one, if you can actually get a spectrum, then that would help you, because you get a hadronic spectrum from pion decay and a lot of other sources. For example, if you have a cosmic ray interacting with a proton, you would get a nice power law without really a break in it. So that would help. This is what's shown here. This is the spectrum. You have the annihilation signal here, and you have two. So this is the interaction with molecular clouds from just protons. And then here's a pulsar nebula. This one, a pulsar, what's it called? Gamma ray pulsar. So this spectrum actually is a bit confusing, could possibly be problematic, but then it turns out gamma ray pulsars are typically near the galactic plane and also would be point sources. So the four criteria really are: one is spectra, second one you don't really expect to have any counterparts in other electromagnetic parts or maybe very diffuse, and then overall the signal should be spatially resolved and you really don't expect any variability. And pretty much any astrophysical candidate that you could confuse with that would fail one or multiple of these criteria. So that's pretty much all I have to say. My conclusions are that based on our simulations, the galactic dark matter halo is really anything but smooth. It's very, very clumpy, all the way down to the smallest mass scales that we can resolve. As expected, the largest subhalos exhibit their own substructure. So if we could actually detect gamma rays from dark matter annihilation of these subhalos, that would be a really spectacular confirmation of lambda CDM, namely abundant small-scale dark matter structure. The signal is very uncertain, so I'm not making a claim that GLAST will definitely detect it, but there is an interesting parameter gene in which GLAST would be able to detect some, and at fairly high significance. And I've said these other points already, so the most detectable ones are very massive, but you also detect some that are unlikely to harbor stars, and they would be well resolved. Thank you.
Other questions?
So I have a few questions. First of all, so you assume a concentration mass relation, which is, I guess, necessary for analysis. But there would be a scatter in that relation. Is that included? Or?
Yeah, that has been included. I mean, so yeah, it has been included. And for the example, the diffuse backline flux, it does make a big difference. You can include the scatter because the high concentration.
But I was thinking of that self-similar model that you have basically to calculate the boost. So is there a
scatter? For the boost factor model, we have not included the scatter. That was just an additional integral that I didn't want to go into. So
that,
I should look into that.
That's going to make a big difference or not. Then. Okay.
It
actually does make a big difference. Yeah, the scatter, so we include the scatter, it makes a pretty big difference.
Yeah, because you would think if there are a few very dense objects, they're going to make a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
It does. I mean, it increases the scatter.
Can you just spend some words how exactly practically you did the boost factor? I mean, you calculated the boost factor,
mm-hmm, yeah.
Depending on the mass, I guess.
Right, exactly. So then.
And then how do you boost it on the map? So.
So we actually go in and change the densities of the particles that belong to that subhalo to boost them up that way.
So this means you boost all particles of the subhalo?
Yeah, that's right. So we don't actually take into account any kind of radial dependence in the boost.
But shouldn't there be radial dependence? I mean, there should be in the outer parts.
I think that's true. I think that's true. There would be. I'm not sure that it would be stronger in the outer parts exactly. So that may actually extend the sources somewhat.
Yeah, but then you get a more extended source. So the area increases, and this will decrease the signal to noise,
yeah,
right?
I mean, it's possible that it could change something. It's something I should look into. So far, I've just sort of uniformly boosted all the particles from it. It was the simplest first thing to do.
So I had two ideas that might be, but short of actual detection of these satellites might help. One is actually looking at anisotropy power spectrum of gamma rays, right? And that's like C sub L's W maxes of CMB. And even though you may not be able to detect these individually, they should introduce some anisotropy, so statistically you might be able to see the
yeah.
effect of them, especially the fainter ones. And I guess the other would be cross-correlating with the stars that BET has.
So even if you don't see an individual source,
yeah.
you still...
Because these are, so the dwarfs, these would be like the massive dwarfs, at least the one that
you
did.
Actually, I was going to throw a comment on the question here. So you said your typical distance is about 20 to 40 from parsecs, and there's about five-ish of these, you know, well-known type objects mm-hmm. in an orbit that's very slow. So if you extrapolate those to the whole sky, that might be your 20 to 40 right there.
Yeah. I mean, it does extend to higher distances too.
And then anisotropy has been, I think, Komatsu actually wrote something up.
That's for the extragalactic, right?
We're doing it right now for the galactic.
For the galactic.
There's a student in Paris and Lydia that's working on that. And we have, we can show some plots.
That's really. The extragalactic would be on much smaller angles, I would guess, than the galactic one. But
So do you have to worry about any of the galactic foregrounds in the dwarfs? I mean, I guess most of them.
There's absolutely zero separation in any dwarf.
There's no gas, but they have
But the LHC is the only one that actually has any observed gamma ray emission by EGRET. Everything else is.
And we heard. I think Beth mentioned earlier that you don't have any gas.
I mean, up to the flux
concentrator. That, I mean, putting it that way, definitely doesn't reassure me, right? Because you know, in other words, if you see gamma rays, if you finally detect the dwarf galaxies we know from the gamma ray, then are you going to assume the star numbers? You know, but what I was wondering more was like, if you look at the gas content, you have to worry about. I mean, if you put cosmic rays interacting with gas,
there's no gas content in dwarf galaxies.
So you would have to follow them. If you see a signal and you see there's a faint one there, you'd have to follow them. Very deep surface.
We should know roughly what the numbers are, right? If we know what the H1 content is.
For the ultra faints, the limits are extremely strict, like 10 solar masses worth of gas.
But at least some of the things you're detecting would be normal. But what was the expression classical for?
And so there's also fairly strict constraints. And so Blitz and Robichaud did a sort of a survey of classical things where they tried to assert that there was some H1 associated with some of them, but none of it's sort of centered on the center of the stellar distribution. So even if some of them do have H1, it might be offset. But the upper limits on the central H1 content aren't nearly as strong as the classical.
And that would be a different spectral signature, so if you get spectra, you can just differentiate between them. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you detect them at 2 sigma,
that's going to be difficult.
Can you go one slide back, Michael? when you showed the number, yeah, so these the scattering in those predictions comes from what? In the predictions, the number of detectable objects.
You mean in here?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is just from choosing different locations. I chose 10 sort of randomly. Okay, all of A keeps you from the center, but that makes a difference.
Other questions? If not, thank Michael again.